Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with the Times' own David Carr about the mysterious Marshall McLuhan, prophet of the media age.
In a fundamental way, he said we become a prisoner of our own tools, and so that the way in which we consume media becomes far more important than what's in the content.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Anand Giridharadas talks about his new book that explores modern India.
It's a country moving at many different speeds. There's a slice of it getting richer, faster, doing better, improving their life chances. There's a much larger slice of it at the very opposite end that is barely moving at all, and in some cases getting displaced by change and becoming worse off.
Jennifer Schussler has bestseller news. All that after this quick message.
The Book Review podcast is brought to you by voice-activated Sync, the easy-to-use in-car connectivity system that gives you voice control of mobile phones and MP3 players and features audible turn-by-turn directions and 911 assist. Available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
Listeners in the New York area, see us live at the Barnes & Noble store on 86th Street and Lexington Avenue at 7 p.m. Monday, January 10th, where I'll be interviewing two authors whose books made the New York Times Book Review's 10 Best of 2010. Jennifer Egan will be there to talk about her novel, A Visit from the Goon Squad, and Siddhartha Mukherjee will discuss Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer. Hope to see you there. Some have been saying for a long time now that the great prophet of our high-speed internet electronic age is Marshall McLuhan. And there's a new book about him. It's called You Know Nothing of My Work, and it's written by another guy who has a prophetic view of the world, the novelist Douglas Copeland, and reviewed for us even better by the Times' own media prophet, David Carr, who's here to talk about it. Hi, David.
I'm not much of a media prophet. I couldn't find the future with both hands, but I'll do my best.
So, McLuhan, how important was he? First, tell us a little bit about him. People don't realize he was a scholar of James Joyce and all the rest. Very interesting background, right?
Yes. You know, he grew up in the provinces of Canada, and I mean that in the nicest way, and he had a very learned mother, and he was, I think the fact that he grew up in the sticks helped him sort of develop in idiosyncratic ways. Mr. Copeland in the book does a very good job of saying, yeah, this guy was a seer. Remember that he did it before there was NASA, before there was a consumer web, before there was, when television was its infancy. What he did was really develop a theoretical framework for a world that we eventually came to occupy.
And without asking an impossible task, because McLuhan, as you say in the review, can be quite difficult, sometimes even opaque. What was the theoretical view that he had? Can you boil it down?
In a fundamental way, he said we become a prisoner of our own tools. And so that the way in which we consume media becomes far more important than what's in the content. And that over and over, and I think that's certainly been true in the web, which he would define as a so-called cool medium because it had many, many inputs from a lot of different people. And that, you know, his most famous phrase, the medium is the message, is the web is its own darn thing, and it has shaped discourse in a certain way and probably shortened our attention span. I mean, what a lot of people view Mr. McLuhan as an evangelist for media and the creation of the global village, he didn't really like any of it. He thought it coarsened discourse. He thought it led people to less substantial thinking. And you have to wonder in the age of Twitter how appalled he would be by what the sort of mediated environment had wrought.
Yes, I mean, McLuhan had a kind of literary term, sort of a classical bent and background. If you read him on Joyce's Ulysses, for
which instance, is an urtext of, like, everything sort of starts in his thinking with Ulysses, and you think, boy, that's going to be some pretty complicated work.
And what about Douglas Copeland? He's an original writer who also is kind of the creator of Generation X, that concept. What does he see in McLuhan? What does he bring to the story of McLuhan?
One of the things about this book, when you first pick it up, it's got all sorts of like little puzzles and diagrams, and you're thinking, what kind of game is he running here? And then you realize where the methodology of the book is kind of reflecting who he is writing about, rather than an 800-pound door-stopping comprehensive biography of McLuhan. You have something that sort of skips and spins and twirls in a very playful way. You know, McLuhan loved puns, loved puzzles. And Copeland, I think, is more than willing to use that same spirit, but in a web age. I mean, Douglas Copeland coined the term Generation X. He is himself like McLuhan, sort of somewhere on the spectrum of autism, probably. And very sensitive to noise, like McLuhan, and also a man with a very Catholic range of interests. I mean, he's a designer, he's a novelist, he's a thinker. And the book is one of those books where you have to be a little bit patient with it. It's like, is this guy running a game on me? What is really going on here? And when you give yourself over to it, it's really fun. It's really fun because, after all, we're talking about really one of the most misunderstood figures in sort of the last century, where everybody thinks they know something about McLuhan, and the title of the book, You Know Nothing of My Work, it's far too apt. I think people in general don't know anything about McLuhan. Yes, he was on the cover of Time magazine. Yes, he was kind of a comet across the sky. I think he became a meme before he became understood. You know, I don't think... Partly because his work is very dense. I don't know how much time you've spent reading him, but I spent some hours on his books. That's some pretty chewy going, Sam.
It's pretty difficult. There are a lot of republications of McLuhan's work, including some in pamphlet form. I looked at one of the first essays that was published in Understanding Media, one of his great books, published in 1954. And he's already using the kind of language and vocabulary that I would expect to hear from Mark Zuckerberg. And yet it's also very demanding and philosophical.
Yeah, and we're talking four decades before the advent of the consumer web, what we think of as sort of the Facebook, Google world. And what allows a person to see over the hill? McLuhan and Copeland makes a good point of this. His brain was wired in a different way. He had like two aortas going to his brain.
You mean this is biologically fact?
Yeah, biologically, that he was wired differently than other people, which is part of what might have made him a sensei of the future, is he did not think in the same way that other people did.
Neither do you, David, and that's why you're our media savant, as we say in the cover of this week's book review.
Thanks, Sam.
Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
And hi, Sam.
Happy 2011.
Happy 2011.
So, Julie, Mark Twain, who's been back in the news for a while, is here again, but for a totally different reason, having to do with his great masterpiece, Huckleberry Finn.
Yes, a Southern publisher called New South Books, they're based in Alabama, announced this week that they're producing a new edition of Huck Finn, and they've decided to take out the N-word and replace it with slave. They've also replaced Injun Joe with Indian Joe. Mm-hmm. And this idea came about from a professor at Auburn University at Montgomery, who's been teaching the book for 40 years now. And he said that he had a lot of trouble teaching the book because he had always stumbled over these words. He was uncomfortable saying them. And he thought that the book was not really being taught as much as it should have been because of this. So he thought this new edition could be useful.
So this is being done not so much to expurgate or clean up this great classic, but somehow to make it more accessible to a new generation of readers and even their teachers.
That seems to be his motivation. Naturally, he's been accused of being politically correct and worse on the internet. But, you know, I spoke to him at length and he said that he really just thought that it was being preemptively censored in a way. He thought that teachers, that schools, libraries weren't stocking it, and that the story and the humor and, you know, the satire that is so rich in the book was being overlooked because people focus so much on the offending language.
Now, do we have any idea what the Twain estate or descendants, if any exist, think of this? Because, of course, what Twain was so immensely proud of in the novel was the accuracy of its idioms and its various dialects. And in some ways, this does kind of cut against what he worked so hard to achieve.
They haven't made a public statement that I've seen. Naturally, the book is in the public domain, so anyone can do what they want with it and produce their own edition. And this book is only being produced in a pretty small run, about 7,500 books at the most. And we're not sure, you know, who's going to buy it or teach it in schools. But the professor who is behind this new edition, Alan Gribben, said that he did not intend this edition to be for scholars. He wanted it to be for younger readers. He thought that even some readers who just were kind of distracted by the language might find it valuable. But certainly it won't be taken seriously as a scholarly edition of the work.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Coming up, India, caught between capitalism and old tradition.
The Book Review Podcast is brought to you by voice-activated Sync, the in-car connectivity system that gives you voice control of your Bluetooth-enabled mobile phone and most MP3 players. And Sync features turn-by-turn directions, 911 assist, real-time traffic and weather, music with the sound of your voice, and your text messages read aloud. All hands-free, so you can keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes on the road. Available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
Readers of the New York Times and the International Herald Tribune have grown familiar in recent years with the wonderful portraits of India provided by a great young journalist, Anand Giridharadas, who has now written a great book. It's called India Calling, An Intimate Portrait of a Nation's Remaking. It's reviewed for us this week by Gayutra Bahadur, who says India Calling is a fine book, elegant, self-aware, and unafraid of contradictions and complexity. I'm delighted that Anand is here to talk about his book. First, congratulations.
Thank you.
All right, India, world's hugest democracy. Tell us, what are some of the contradictions and complexities as this enormous nation enters the modern age?
Above all, it's a country moving at many different speeds, in many different gears. There's a slice of it that is getting richer, faster, doing better, improving their life chances faster than anybody in the West. There's a much larger slice of it at the very opposite end that is barely moving at all and in some cases getting displaced by change and becoming worse off. And there's a lot of people in the middle who are seeing their lives incrementally, slowly improve. But more than that, acquiring a new idea of life that is much more focused on the self and the fulfillment and joy of the self rather than the family, the tribe, the caste, and who are acquiring the idea that they make their fate rather than inherit it. And in India, that could not be a more subversive idea.
Anand, part of this book, a great excerpt ran in the Sunday Times Magazine, and there you talked about or introduced us to the Dale Carnegie of India, whom we met. Tell us a little bit about him, how you got to know him, and how he's created this very modern life for himself on the one hand, but still tugged at by old, old obligations and traditions.
He was born very close to the lowest of the Indian low in a very small village called Bhiwapur in the center of India, and grew up in the kind of environment where his father, grandfather, great-grandfather would not have imagined ever being anything other than what they were, which is sharecroppers, coolies who load things on and off trucks, those kinds of jobs. And for some reason, he just got this idea of life that I'm not going to be my father. I'm not going to be just this. And so he set out to get out. And he did that by first, in a way, being a customer of Dale Carnegie ideas, reading Dale Carnegie's book 28 times. And he watched TV. He saw people for the first time whose lives were light years ahead of his. And he didn't know anybody like that. He couldn't even see people like that in his town. And he took one skill class, electrician skills, sewing, computer programming, English, paying $10, $20 each time to learn these different skills because the school system was still too kind of encrusted to help him, and clearly pulled himself up by the bootstraps, as we say.
And he's a real entrepreneur.
He's a real entrepreneur. After all these classes, he decided, having been the customer of Dale Carnegie kind of stuff, to become the producer. And so he now does for others what was once done for him.
So he created a beauty pageant, a skating academy.
Roller skating academy, and an event management company, and most importantly, an English language academy. So today, if you are like Ravindra in the town where he works, you have to see him to get out of town. He helps people get out of town.
And he's called Sir. He has exalted status locally.
Generally, and this is an interesting shift in India more generally, calling someone Sir or Saab in Hindi would come with age and title and prestige. But as a sign of what's changing, there are those occasional young people, he's probably about 30 years old now, who have earned Sir because he is so respected by children and parents alike in that town because they know he is their portal to the world.
And then he falls in love. And what happens?
He falls in love and...
And you met her and in fact, you had a kind of confidential conversation with her. Who is she?
She is a teacher. He's a guest lecturer at several schools, and she is one of the officials, like a deputy principal or something like that, at one of the schools where he teaches. She was very much in awe of this guy. And it almost reminds you of the Clintons, where there's a kind of love and ambition are very closely mingled together. They love each other.
A power couple,
right? It's a young Indian power couple. And they are, in many ways, saying everything they want to say to each other through text messages, but unable to say those things in person. So I got involved. I went back to kind of middle school days of doing, you know, romantic shuttle diplomacy because these they wouldn't say anything to each other, but they both started telling me as I was interviewing them separately that, you know, I feel so strongly about her and what do I do? And, you know, and she would say, I'm hoping for some kind of – that he asked me to marry him, but I'm not sure if he's going to do it. And so I kind of raised the issue, and it turns out they were both more interested than they suggested. But she told me in the end that he was from the same caste as her. He was even from the same subcaste as her.
And briefly, how many different subcastes potentially are we talking
about?
In
the terms in which I'm defining it, you can broadly say there are four castes and then a fifth untouchability, which loosely correspond to the European feudal system of priests, knights, merchants, and laborers. And in India, laborers are subdivided further into non-polluted laborers and polluted laborers, and the polluted ones are the untouched former untouchables. But that's actually not how most Indians would divide it. Most Indians divide it into subcastes. When there are thousands of these subcastes.
Thousands. People identify themselves and one another by these castes. Like when these two met
100 years ago, it would be a lot more strong than it is today. Today, if you go to an Indian village, people will still be quite clear who's who and who lives where and what markings they put on their head and what they wear and what they eat. The further you go up the income ladder or towards the city, the more that erodes. If you and I are riding on a crowded city bus in Bombay and our elbows are kind of forced into each other, no one cares or can care about whether you're untouchable or not. It's just beyond practicality. But the idea that your status is kind of an intrinsic fact, a fact that you can't change, remains very strong in India.
So in the case of these two then, what was the problem?
So they both belong to the same kind of meta caste as I was describing, which is the laboring caste. They both belong to the specific subcaste within the laboring, which is called telis, which is oil seed crushers. It's kind of seed that gives oil, and people who crushed that seed to generate oil were telis. They're both telis. But in India, there's always a catch, and the catch here was that they were not from the same subcaste. They were telis of different varieties. And in the end, the girl was unwilling to defy her family in marrying the wrong kind of Thali. She rejected him, and he begged me to call her. I know a bad idea when I see one, and that seemed like a spectacularly bad idea, but I did it. And she said five words that ended everything and that just reminded me of how old and new are so closely intermingled in India. She said, "I love my family more."
Now, that's just one of the great stories you tell in this book. How did you settle on the people who became the vehicle for telling this enormous story? Who are some of the others you write
about? So Ravindra, who I talk about, is the kind of anchor of chapter two, after talking about a lot of my family in the first chapter. The next chapter after Ravindra is mainly about the Ambani family, Dhirubhai Ambani, who is now dead, one of the great industrialists of modern India, and his son Mukesh, India's richest man. In a way, those two chapters both are about a view of modern India that's about ambition and uplift. The book then turns to two Maoist revolutionaries in the following chapter, uncle and nephew. They're poets, poet revolutionaries, so they've never killed a man themselves as far as I know, but do what they do through poetry. And what I tried to do with them is U-turn and ask them to, in a way, re-describe the same scenery that I've taken readers through of malls and ambition and English academies and roller skating and billionaires, and ask them to kind of go back over the whole thing from a Maoist insurgency point of view. What do they see when they see the new India? One of them, the younger one, I put it to him that I didn't understand what they were fighting, because they are against both the old feudal India of landlords, and one of them told me the story of the old landlords used to work these women in the villages so hard, and some of them would have young infants and would ask for time to breastfeed their infants. And they would say, "Well, no, you can, you know, squeeze milk into these little clay pots and we'll take it to the infant." And these women got there and squeezed milk into the clay pots, and the landlord would take the clay pot and throw it in the fields. This was this is the old India of landlord-peasant humiliation that the Maoist fight began against about 40 years ago. Today, the Maoists are more famous for fighting GE and Microsoft and Citibank as they try to come to India. They're anti-globalization. And so I said to these guys, "What are you really against? I mean, these are two completely different fights in a way." And he said something very interesting, and I don't know that I agree with it, but it's an interesting idea. In a way, what caste and the old rural world were doing were pigeonholing people and shrinking people and denying the fullness of a human being, and squeezing them into this kind of tiny fraction of a self that only does their little job and doesn't question. And the new economy, in their view, does the same thing in a very fancy, gilded way, but essentially is the same thing. They see as kind of a cousin in deprivation that woman squeezing her milk and having it thrown, and the new economy software worker who works 15-hour days and is suffering impotence and marriage is falling apart and their kids never see them and their software factory requires a bunch of villagers to be driven off their land. They see the modern global playing field as being as cruel in its own way as the old world.
And what about yourself? You say you're one of India's stepchildren. And tell us briefly about your background and history.
I grew up to Indian parents who had left India in the 70s and moved to the U.S., first to Ohio, and then we lived in Europe for a bit, and then Washington, D.C. It's funny how geopolitics, in a way, trickles down into something as simple as kind of middle school popularity. But India was not the kind of place you wanted to be from in the 80s and 90s.
You mean if you were in the United States?
In the United States. It was not a heritage I wanted to acknowledge. It was kind of seen as a kind of third world dump and place with no possibility, and so who would want to associate themselves with that? And that was slowly revealed to me to be a mistaken way to grow up. And as I got older, I matured, but more importantly, India changed and began to awaken in some of the ways we've talked about. Around the time I was graduating from college, I wanted to be a writer but didn't quite know how to become a writer. And so I thought going somewhere interesting that would be challenging and take me out of my comfort zone would be the right thing to do. And so I moved to India to try to kind of reclaim what I had always pushed away. And it was really in writing that I had this platform for sorting out my relationship to a place that in a way I had given less time to understanding than I'd given almost any place else.
Will your book be published in India?
It will be, just a few weeks after it's published here. For an American audience, a Western audience, there's a value in explaining the contradictions of India and the extraordinary churning that's going on. For an Indian audience, I think I worry that there's too little reflection and conversation in go-go places like India and China about who we are, who are we becoming, what kind of great power do we want to be. Part of what I intend with the book is also to kind of stimulate that kind of reflection in India and to stimulate a conversation in India about, okay, now that we're rich, now that we're powerful, to what end?
I guess we'll find out.
I hope so.
Thanks a lot, Anand.
Thank you, Sam.
That's Anand Giridharadas, whose new book, India Calling, An Intimate Portrait of a Nation's Remaking, is reviewed in this week's book review. Jennifer Schuessler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
Tell me what's new on the list this week in 2011.
Well, there is something new on the list this week in 2011. A couple books, actually, after having the list be totally frozen up with all that Christmas shopping for the past 3 weeks. We've got a new number one on the fiction list. Dean Koontz is back with a book called What the Night Knows. It's a crime story about the sort of mysterious murders of entire families, which sounds like a post-holiday fantasy, if you ask me.
Don't look at me. My family's still alive, last I checked. What about nonfiction?
Well, the big news here is that Laura Hillenbrand breaks George Bush. Her book, Unbroken, crawls up to number one. It's been at number two for a couple of weeks. And George Bush drops to number two with Decision Points. He had a 7-week run at the top of the list, which, for the record, is 1 week longer than his wife, Laura, had with her book, Spoken from the Heart.
So together, 13 weeks. They're the lucky or unlucky power political couple.
Yep.
Very impressive. Now, what about True Grit? Back on the list?
It is, in the wake of the much-praised Coen Brothers movie. It's number 11 on the trade paperback list. It's been on the list for a couple of weeks, actually. And it's not the first time it's been a bestseller. It hit the list back in 1968, possibly because of a little bit of skullduggery on the part of staffers at Paramount Pictures, which at the time, they had bought rights to the movie. The book had first appeared as a serial in the Saturday Evening Post. And in order to kind of drum up publicity for the movie, they're like, we need to get this book on the bestseller list. This was all sort of boasted by one of the former executives to the Times reporter, Michael Sipley, recently. And he claimed that he sent out a bunch of people to go buy up whole boxes of books at stores that they knew were being monitored by the Times bestseller list. And sure enough, the book hit the list. It entered at number 3 and hung on for 22 weeks, which is quite amazing.
Well, True Grit is a very interesting story. It's a kind of classic. Some will remember that the novelist Donna Tartt is a huge fan, who wrote a very elegant essay about it, I think in The Guardian in England. And Portis is the author, Charles Portis, who lives in Little Rock, as you know, is hugely admired, especially by Southern writers, is a really maybe consequential voice in our literature.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting that, I mean, obviously Portis wrote several books, you know, not just Westerns. He hasn't published a book since 1991 when Gringos came out. But, you know, while the Western is sort of faded as a, you know, kind of hardcore genre, you see lots of vampire novels, you know, procedural crime stories, that kind of thing on the bestseller lists. Not a lot of Westerns, unless there are these kind of highbrow literary updatings from people like Cormac McCarthy. He's had a number of bestsellers, Annie Prue with Brokeback Mountain, and Larry McMurtry, who, you know, is sort of maybe a bit of a different case. He's kind of more of a classicist, although a very literary writer, but his approach to the Western is a bit more kind of classical. And he, you know, Lonesome Dove, I think it spent half a year on the list back in 1986. And some of these books earn very high praise. I mean, no less than Harold Bloom is on record as saying that Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian is the finest work by a living American writer, which is quite an amazing thing to say. And in the wake of this, the sort of revival of True Grit, there's been a lot of talk about what's the best American novel. And, you know, some people say that their vote should go to Thomas Berger's Little Big Man, which came out in 1964, also made into a movie in 1970.
With Dustin Hoffman.
Dustin Hoffman, yes. And that book did not make the bestseller list at any point in its life. But, you know, who needs Harold Bloom or the bestseller list when you've got Janis Joplin? Reportedly, Little Big Man was one of her favorite books.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.